Good morning, everyone. A couple of announcements before we start Grand Rounds. First, as many of you know, this weekend is the 15th Annual Internal Medicine Conference here at Boca Raton Regional. It's actually at the Marriott on Military Trail. The registration is still open, and we encourage everybody, including the residents, to attend. I think I heard that the residents are off on Friday, if that's correct. No? Someone told us you were giving off on Friday. No, that wasn't true.
Like six residents in the clinic.
In the outpatient.
Oh, in the clinic we're giving off. Oh. Well, if I could let you off, I would, but I don't think I'm allowed to. Anyways, though, if you can make it, it's Friday afternoon, noon till 5, Saturday morning and Sunday morning. The brochures are out there. There's some good talks. Come to as many or as few as you can get to. The other announcement is that May 25th, it's a Friday, which, again, is obviously going to be tough for the residents, but if you can, we're having a cardiovascular and stroke symposium that's going to be run by Drs. Harrison Espinoza. And they've got a really good program. Again, it's free to the residents and to the staff at Boca Raton Regional. This morning, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Leonard Hock, who is the Chief Medical Officer of TrustBridge Palliative and Advanced Care here in Boca. Dr. Hock was an internist in private practice before developing a major interest in geriatric and palliative care and end-of-life issue, and he is a local and national expert on the topic. And today he's going to give us a talk on a very, very important and appropriately timed talk on pain management and the opioid issue, especially in light of the fact that Governor Scott signed the opioid bill yesterday. So again, it is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Hock.
Thank you. Thanks very much. You know, I hear you mention the residents and then off, and I think the only thing that residents ever know about off is that it's an insect repellent. It's not free time. It's not free time. Yeah. So right now, today we're going to talk about current issues, pain management. And Governor Scott did sign the bill based on the opioid crisis. And there are actually two major opioid crises. The one that's in the news that we hear about every day is the addiction crisis, the deaths, the addiction that occurs because of opioids. The other crisis is there aren't enough of them. And right now, our crisis is healthcare, is that we don't have enough pharmaceutical opioids to completely manage what it is we're trying to manage, which is usually pain. So that's what I wanted to talk about today. Actually, there was a cancellation, and I was invited to come. I was a bench player, but happy to come off the bench. So my talk today is really a talk and a discussion. So I wanted to talk about pain. Pain is an uncomfortable symptom, often with severe anxiety, that leads to real or potential tissue injury. So if you think about pain, if you cut your finger with a knife, you would retract. If you touched a hot stove, you would reflexively jump back. If you had colicky pain in your bowel, you would bent over, and if it didn't go away, you'd come to the emergency room and find out. So pain is an uncomfortable and alarming symptom that indicates real or potential tissue injury, which is why we do everything naturally we can to get away from pain, to avoid pain. Pain comes in several different descriptive ways. So let me tell you about the anatomy of pain. So the anatomy of pain is that we have pain sensors, actually transducers, in many areas of our body. And if we think about skin, but we can talk about the pericardium or the pleura or the small intestine or the capsules that surround the liver, the spleen, the gallbladder. So pain, the anatomy of pain, is that there is a receptor or a transducer that changes one energy form into a nerve electrical energy. So it can be a crushing injury, a stabbing injury, a burning injury, a pressure injury, and that is converted at that transducer, changing one energy form to another, to electrical impulses in the nerves that go to the dorsal thalamic tract of the spinal cord and then up the spinal cord to our brain, where we perceive that kind of pain. So transduction, transmission, and then perception of pain. Pain comes as nociceptive pain. Nociceptive pain is pain from a stimuli in a normal anatomy, normal transducer, normal nerves to transmit, normal spinal thalamic tract, normal perception. And that nociceptive pain with normal anatomy can generally be divided into somatic pain, muscle, joint, connective tissue, ankle sprains, fractures, muscle soreness, fasciitis, somatic pain, or visceral pain, which is internal pain. And visceral pain, we often think of colicky pain, a deep or a cramping kind of pain, can be pericardial pain, pleurisy, pleural pain, capsular swelling of the spleen, and hematologic diseases are that visceral pain. So nociceptive pain, normal anatomy, somatic or visceral. Then, as opposed to nociceptive pain, is neuropathic pain. Neuropathic pain means that the nerves in that normal transmission of pain in the anatomy, the nerves are damaged. And the nerves can be damaged many different ways. Demyelination syndromes like multiple sclerosis, crushing syndromes like sciatica, vertebral compression, microvascular ischemic syndromes like in diabetic neuropathic pain. And neuropathic pain means there is no normal stimuli to cause the pain, but the pain is caused by abnormal, diseased, or impaired nerves. Pain can also be divided into acute and chronic. So where do you think the opioid crisis happens? In acute pain, usually defined as less than 6 months, but if you think about this pragmatically, if you had an ankle fracture or appendicitis and an appendectomy or a baby, when after that would you likely, in the normal phases of healing and recovery, would you not have pain? Do you think 6 weeks later? 6 weeks after surgery, after a fracture, after a baby, you'd be comfortable again? Probably so, although pain experts define pain, chronic pain and acute pain, as a 6 month. Less than 6 months is considered acute. Longer than 6 months is considered. I think I drifted away from... So acute pain is 6 months or less. I think it's actually less than that. Chronic pain is 6 months or more, and I think probably 6 weeks, 3 months would start to define chronic pain. So where does the opioid crisis occur? In people who are prescribed. Now, many people in the crisis were never prescribed anything. They got it, found it out of the medicine cabinet or off the street. But in prescribed therapy, where do you think that happens? And it's chronic pain. It's people that come with chronic pain, chronic head pain, chronic back pain, when they come to fool us or myth us about their pain so that we would write prescriptions. And as you may know, certainly us longtime practicing physicians and nurse practitioners and PAs know that several years ago, might have been 2 or 3 licensure cycles ago, if we were going to prescribe pain medicines for chronic pain syndromes, we had to make a check, and we still do, on our medical license application every year, and this is a licensure year, that we prescribe for chronic pain. And it was an effort to decrease the pill mill doctors. And it had effect, but it didn't always have a perfect effect because, first of all, nursing homes were not exempt. Many people in nursing homes have geriatric syndromes, many somatic pain syndromes in long-term care. Geriatric joint stiffening, muscle withering, and contractures that are chronic pain and would deserve to be treated. But nursing homes were not exempt, and so nursing home physicians were automatically engaged in this chronic pain prescribing. And initially, and still, hospices were not exempt from prescribing. So the bill back then, not Governor Scott's bill yesterday, but the bill back then ended up having not an amendment, but clarification that geriatricians, long-term care, and hospice and palliative physicians were exempt from this pill mill chronic pain prescribing authority of the bill two or three license cycles ago. So acute pain is short-term pain, and that's very good for us. So most of the pain that we see in hospitals is acute pain. Myocardial infarction pain, gallbladder pain, appendiceal pain, bony fractures. So most of the pain that we see. But people come to us with chronic pain and whatever their condition is. And the approach and the treatment is different. In acute pain, less than 6 months, and I would say much less than that, there is often a way to diagnose and find the pain. And if you can identify the pain, then you can treat the etiology of the pain, whether it's somatic pain or visceral pain, neuropathic pain, and you can focus your approach toward the etiology of the pain. Vertebral compression fraction, chronic splenic engorgement with capsular pain, and you can really focus and diagnose. Now, in chronic pain, it ends up not having great descriptors. Well, I hurt all over, it's an achy pain, when does it start? It's all the time, but it's worse in the morning. Where does it go? All over my body. You know these generalities of descriptors that come with chronic pain, and it is difficult, although we should attempt, to identify the etiology of chronic pain. Chronic and acute pain, therefore, would be treated differently. So if we identify the etiology, the cause of the pain, how can we treat the pain? And the World Health Organization for 25 years, as long as I have studied symptom management, not just pain management, but symptom management, the World Health Organization has had their three tiers of pain management. That would be tier number two, annoying. Annoying. So tier number one is mild pain, pain that you all think that a Tylenol, an Aleve, an Advil, a rest would take care of. Tension, headache, pain, mild soccer muscle strain, pain, stepping off the curb wrong and twisting your ankle, it's going to be better in a few days. Having a tooth pulled kind of pain, that kind of pain probably can be treated with a non-opioid first-level analgesics. Then second-level pain are the mild opioids, Ultram, codeine. And remember about codeine, the youngsters, Tylenol number three, Tylenol number three. Well, codeine has to be metabolized several times before it is morphine, and it's a tiny dose of morphine that affects the morphine receptors. So codeine is actually quite a weak pain medicine, but it is a great antitussive. It's a great cough medicine, and actually we use it sometimes as an antidiarrheal because, you know, any of the opioids can cause constipation. That's the one side effect of opioids that does not go away. Other side effects, we'll talk about some of those, finally do resolve. So the second level would still be the Aleve and Advil, perhaps with the addition of a mild opioid like Vicodin, Norco, Lortab, which is hydrocodone. Hydrocodone does not come in a free state. It's attached to aspirin, a non-steroidal Tylenol. And so it is interesting, so I'll just tell a quick antidote. I was working in hospice and palliative care elsewhere before I came. I should have come earlier to Boca. It's the place to be. But before I came here, I had a hospice patient and I had put the hospice patient on 2 milligrams of morphine, PRN, every 6 hours. They were having mild pain. It wasn't frequent pain. So 2 milligrams of morphine, oral morphine, actually, every 6 hours, PRN, and that comforted them. So they went back to rural Florida, and their physician there looked at this and said, morphine? My God, you don't need morphine. What are they trying to do, cause respiratory depression? Are they trying to knock you off? So the doctor there ordered Vicodin, 5-325, 2 tabs every 4 hours, PRN pain. So do you think they benefited that patient in pain management? Yes, they got more pain management. But hydrocodone orally and morphine orally, and we talk a lot about equal analgesic equivalents, how to change. So oral hydrocodone and oral morphine, what do you think is the equal analgesic equivalent? It's 1-to-1. It's 1-to-1. So my 2 milligrams of morphine, and he gave Vicodin 5-325, 2, so he was giving 10 milligrams of an equal analgesic dose. He was giving that 6 times a day PRN every 4 hours instead of my 4 times a day every 6 hours. So patient was certainly relieved, but they did not do what they intended to do, was to get away from that horrible connotation of morphine and put them on something milder. They actually gave them more medication. Equal analgesic dosing is very important when you get to the third tier, and the third tier really is the use of opioids, and the common opioids are morphine. It is our gold standard, morphine is. Morphine can be given orally, sublingually, it can be given by a spray, it can be given IV, subcutaneous IM, in palliative medicine, not hospital medicine, but in palliative medicine, we will do anything we can not to give anything IM. IM hurts, and it's not the quickest absorbed. So IV or sub-Q, parenterally, but not IM. In the hospitals, it comes IM. That's how we give it. So we try not to do IM. But morphine can be given orally, rectally, under the tongue. It can be between the cheek and the gum. It can be given in just about any way. It is short-acting, intermediate-acting, long-acting, and we can schedule morphine anyway. And so morphine ends up being the gold standard to which we compare the other opioids for both dose and frequency. So morphine IV, 1 milligram, or sub-Q, or even IM, but 1 milligram of morphine parenterally equals how many milligrams of morphine orally? 3 milligrams orally. So 10 milligrams of IV morphine would be 30 milligrams of PO morphine. And that's very important because I will tell you that even in hospice or palliative medicine, where we all are experts and should be, we see conversions that don't match the equal analgesic conversions. So morphine, dilaudid, fentanyl, hydrocodone again, are all opioids in that third tier. And that third tier is often very important to comfort acute pain. They are used occasionally for chronic pain, but in acute pain, we use many different pain scales. The barometer, we use the 1 to 10 scale, the visual analog scale. So 1 is the way that we feel. We couldn't feel better. We have no pain. Life is good. 10 is the worst pain that you could ever imagine and has been described as too severe to even acknowledge how severe it is. Somebody would be whimpering, crying, moaning, contracted in pain, and couldn't even tell us. It is the kind of pain that's written about that if it persisted someone would think that they would rather end their life than continue to have a level 10 pain. So I remember in med school that our professors talked about the two most painful syndromes that we could imagine. I don't know if it's true. I think sometimes we heard a lot of things. But trigeminal neuralgia, tic de la rue, was one, and renal stones was the other worst pain you could have. I'm sure that delivering moms would think that's the worst pain that you could have. And I think there are many cancer pain syndromes that are incredibly painful. But it is those kind of diagnosis, conditions, and syndromes in which we see the 8, 9, and 10 so severe that immediate action is required on our part. So in the principles of pain management, if we go in and somebody and we discover right now someone who's in severe pain and they has not been addressed, our approach to this pain is pretty clear and pretty simple. And this is a principle I think that's worth taking away. If somebody's having neuropathic pain, somatic pain, or visceral pain, and it is severe in the 8, 9, or 10 level, then our approach to that pain is do something right now with a potent medication. That can be morphine, it can be Dilaudid, it could be fentanyl IV, it could be one of the short-acting, remember I said about morphine, it's short-acting, intermediate, and long-acting, but initially a short-acting. And we give a dose that is sufficient to calm that pain to bring it down to some level less than an 8, 9, or 10 on the analog scale. And we measure that pain, both for time and for intensity. If the patient says, "Doc, I felt okay half an hour later, but 2 hours later the pain was coming back and I couldn't have the medicine for 4 hours, the hospital culture is every 4 hours, PRN. But in symptom management, we don't care about the culture. We care about the pain. Dr. Bennett, one of my professors, said, remember that you own the prescription and that prescription is you, and don't let the nurse or the medical student or the patient or their family talk you into writing something different than you want. And I remember that because that is incredibly wrong. What we want to do is have the patient comfortable. So the prescription is not the limit. The symptom is the limit. So when it comes to morphine, what is the highest therapeutic dose of morphine? Anybody want to guess? There is none. There is none. That's exactly right. So what is the limit on the frequency that morphine can be given? There is none. Of course, we do it in patient-controlled analgesic pumps, so they get it continuously. So our objective is to control the pain. But what's the pushback? Well, morphine has the connotation, as in the doctor I told you about earlier that would rather use more Vicodin than less morphine, is that morphine is bad and it automatically leads to addiction, and that it's going to cause respiratory depression. You're going to knock your patient off. So let me get rid of that myth. None of the opioids cause respiratory depression until they cause cognitive depression. So you're not, even in your COPD, the American College of Chest Physicians every couple of years does a white paper that says that for symptoms of breathlessness, suffocation, shortness of breath, the gold standard is morphine for comforting that shortness of breath. So if you give enough and then you give too much, because we want to give enough but not too much, if you give too much and you sedate the patient, then you can cause respiratory depression. Or if the patient is sedate and you give, I don't know why you'd give morphine for pain in a sedate patient, but if you gave it, then you can cause respiratory depression. You cannot cause respiratory depression with an appropriate dose of morphine in an awake patient. So every day I hear that we can't give morphine because of the fear of respiratory depression. If that patient and that person is having a symptom of pain and we can comfort it and they're awake, then we need to start. So here's how we would dose so that we don't cause sedation respiratory depression. We would give what we believe is an appropriate dose. So an appropriate dose depends on that patient, whether they're rapid metabolizer, the efficacy of their mitochondria, what their receptor status is, and we can't figure all that out in 5 minutes. So when I did my first endocrinology rotation, I was sent up to a young woman's room, 22 years old, with diabetic ketoacidosis, and her sugar was 800. So I called the endocrinologist, and I said, well, how much insulin should I give her? Remember, this is 40 years ago. And he said, well, you're here to know that. He said, would you give her 2 units of insulin? I said, no, that doesn't seem like nearly enough. And he said, would you give her 200 units of insulin? I said, whoa, it seems like quite a lot. He said, you're exactly right. So give her somewhere between 2 and 200 units of insulin. So the point is that we have to make a reasonable decision and then adjust it. And exactly the same true of opioids and morphine. So we might give 2 or 4 or 6 milligrams parenterally, IV or sub-Q. So the Cmax is when it's available. And if it's given IV or sub-Q, it's going to be available. It's going to start to show in about 15 minutes. And it's going to be maximally available in about 30 minutes parenterally. IV is a little bit quicker than that. IM is a little slower than that. Sub-Q is about there. So in 45 minutes, come back and check on the patient. Now they're getting the dose effect. And if they come back and they're saying, I don't even feel it, well, then the principle is if they still have severe pain, it's 100% increase in the dose. So if I gave 4 milligrams, next time I give 8 milligrams. If they say it's a little better but I'm still hurting, if they're having moderate pain, maybe the 6 and 7 on the 10 scale, you would give them 50% more. So if you gave 4 milligrams, now you give 6. If they say, now it feels okay, you know, I still have it, but I'm a lot better, then that's the dose. Now you ask about the frequency. Well, doc, it helped in about half an hour, but 2 hours later the pain came back. So the Q4 hour scale is not right. It needs to be Q2 hours so that you match the pain. So your prescription needs to be not related to the prescription pad, but related to the patient's symptom. I use morphine as the gold standard. It could be fentanyl IV, not the patch. It's long acting. We'll get there. It could be Dilaudid. And it could be nowadays bringing back the demon, Demerol. Remember, we got rid of Demerol, if you even remember Demerol. But now it's coming back because of the opioid crisis we're having. There's not enough of the good stuff, the morphines, the Dilaudids, and the other. And that's our crisis. And so now we're going to have to refresh our memory on what's the doses of Demerol. I can tell you, as a med student, intern, and resident, it was, yeah, totally easy, wasn't it? 50 milligrams of Demerol, 25 of Visperdal every 4 hours PRN. And if that didn't help them, something was wrong with them. Well, it was wrong with them. They were still hurting. But that's our attitude 40, 30, 25 years ago. But as we got more accustomed to the other opioids, Demerol faded away. But now in a supply crisis for healthcare, it is coming back. In fact, our pharmacy here is ordering more Demerol because we cannot get stock of morphine, Dilaudid, and some of the others. So that's our opioid crisis. So my example of morphine, so let me just do this again. Start with what you think is a reasonable dose. 2, 4, 6, 8 milligrams. IV. If it's super acute pain and you're discovering it, check back on the patient every hour or so because you've hit the Cmax and the bioavailability and the maximum effect in an hour, and check on their pain. And if they're still having severe pain, now you're going to increase the dose by 100%. I will tell you, that's interesting. In the hospital, to go to 4 to 8 milligrams, it's whoa. You know, their pupils may constrict, but our pupils dilate when we think of doses like that. But the literature now suggests that in severe pain, if you come back in an hour and they're still having pain, you might increase the dose 200%. I have not yet done that, but some of the literature suggests that you've got to be more aggressive with acute severe pain management. Then you dose the frequency that matches the patient's symptoms. So if the pain is still severe, 8, 9, or 10, increase the dose 100%, check on the frequency. If the pain is still moderate, 5, 6, 7, increase the dose by 50%, check on the frequency. And if you've captured the pain, good for you. After 24 hours, you want to add up the total dose of morphine, Dilaudid, oxycodone, hydrocodone, and then you want to start to calculate a long-acting dose, a long-acting dose of whatever you choose. Some of the classic long-acting medicines are methadone and the fentanyl patch. But morphine comes in a long-acting dose, and so do others. So MS Contin is an 8 or a 12-hour dose of morphine. So you want to add up the total dose of analgesic opioid that the patient received and comforted them. If they weren't comfortable, then you didn't give enough. So you want to add up the total dose of the medicine that comforted them, and then you want to schedule that with a long-acting and keep about a 30% of that dose as their PRN breakthrough dose. And that's still scheduled according to their schedule, every 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, or 6 hours. And so in the hospital where we have patients for 2, 3, 4, 5 days, case management starts to get on us if it's longer than that, then you can capture their pain in the first 24 hours with short-acting medications, adjusting frequency to meet their comfort needs, then add the long-acting medicine by calculating the 24-hour dose and leaving in place about 30% of the 24-hour dose in aliquots of every 4 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours, whatever they need. So short-acting and long-acting medicines. But in the chronic pain, we wouldn't approach it with a short-acting way. In chronic pain, that's where patients truly have chronic pain syndromes or don't have chronic pain syndromes but have addictions. So as I was coming here today, I thought I wanted to just talk about definitions. So there are three topics, three words that always go with opioids. One is tolerance. We do develop tolerance. It's a natural physiologic effect of opioids and some other medicines, by the way, that we start to metabolize them quicker, so it takes a larger dose. That is a natural phenomenon. That does not mean something's wrong with our prescribing or with the patient. So if a dose of morphine, as my example, but remember the other opioids work, if a dose of morphine, let's say MS Contin, 30 milligrams every 12 hours with breakthrough of a short-acting morphine, Roxanol liquid under the tongue, or a little MSER, immediate-release morphine tablet, not used very often. So 30 milligrams of long-acting morphine every 12 hours satisfies the patient to a 3 or 4 level pain on the scale. You can anticipate that days later or a week later, that 30 milligrams every 12 hours is really going to need to be 30 milligrams every 8 hours, and they'll start increasing the use of their PRN. So tolerance is a natural physiologic response to opioids, and so count on it, plan on it. It does not mean anything is wrong. It's expected. Dependence, I don't want to become dependent. I don't want mom to become dependent on morphine. Do you hear that? Well, dependence is also natural, and it's really an interesting phenomena to me. So do you think a patient with pathologic life-threatening ventricular arrhythmia who takes amiodarone and then reduces the pathologic arrhythmia becomes dependent on amiodarone? Do you think a type 1 diabetic becomes dependent on insulin? So we were surveyed at a nursing home, and the surveyor came through and said, I've just visited with Miss Zemanski, and you have a diagnosis of depression with reclusive behaviors, and you have her on a dose of Zoloft. But I talked to her, and she says that she's not depressed, and now she enjoys activities. So you need to stop the antidepressant. But it is because of the antidepressant that she can be engaged in social activity. She's become dependent on that medication to not be depressed and not be isolated and reclusive. So is it surprising that if somebody had a fractured ankle and you gave them doses of morphine, low doses, appropriate doses of morphine, the pain was soothed, and then you said, well, I stopped the pain, no more morphine for you after the first day. Do you think they become dependent on the pain med? That's, to me, is even a silly concept. That's the same as insulin and diabetes. So, yes, they become dependent on the medicine to get the desired outcome for no other reason. But addiction is the problem. Addiction. Let me say about addiction. In acute hospital settings, for all of the opioids that we use, if we had them available, less than 1% of our patients become addicted. Less than 1%. In hospice, for a couple of reasons, almost nobody becomes addicted. One is they can't live long enough, or they don't usually. And the other is if you're using the medications to control pain or an uncomfortable symptom, addiction is not a result. So addiction is the unrelenting craving for opioid medications, not for medical use, that is life destructive. I think I paraphrased that definition, but let me do it again. The unrelenting craving, that means they never give it up when they're addicted. And if it's unrelenting, will they do almost anything to satisfy that craving? And it's non-medical. It's a non-medical craving for these opioid medications that is life-destructive. So it can be liver-destructive, kidney-destructive, brain-destructive. It can be overdose, and any dose that's non-medical, I think, is an overdose. But it can be an overdose that does cause sedation and respiratory depression and death, which is why I think Narcan is more available now. But it's not just medically or clinically life-destructive. It destroys careers, marriages, life. It destroys goals. It destroys potential and ability. So addiction is the non-medical, unrelenting craving for the opioids. So what is it that they're craving? They're craving whatever the psychology of addiction is. Separation from reality. They're looking for their own comfortable place. They're looking for null emotions. They're looking to sleep their life away so that it feels better. They're looking for the buzz. Initially, they're looking for the buzz, but as it starts to destroy their tissues, their careers, their brains, and their life, then they're just looking for the drugs because it feels uncomfortable not to have the drugs. Because with withdrawal, they feel very, very uncomfortable. So tolerance is a natural expected effect. Dependence is, yes, if you want the desired effect, you give whatever therapeutic intervention you can. So therapeutic interventions. Let me talk about some chronic pain and even acute. So I've certainly talked about the medications, how to initiate acute pain medication. But let's talk about non-medications. So for many pains, neuropathic, nociceptive, visceral, somatic, there are other modalities, and a couple are distraction and diversion. If you go to a nursing home with chronic geriatric syndromes, you'll see bingo and Oprah and activities and weaving, and there'll be a hairdresser, and they're having manis and pedis, mostly manis because they don't want to touch their diabetic toes, but they're doing distraction therapy, diversion therapy, visual imagery, pet therapy, music activities. Because if you don't think about the pain scale reporting will actually go down. So diversion and distraction therapies, and you name them, there's more all the time, even some exercise therapies. And then physical and occupational therapies, not for restoration or recovery, but for comfort. So heat, so repositioning, cold packs, TENS units, so flexion, contracture exercises. There are many interventions that can make a huge difference. We know that pain is also accompanied, as I first said, by anxiety. So there are many non-opioid medications that help comfort the associated with symptoms of pain. So anxiolytics about pain. So the Ativans and the Xanaxes. And by the way, Xanax is so short-acting, it's very potent, so they feel less anxious right away, but it's very short-acting, so 3 hours later they're anxious again. So if you want to have a cycle of anxiety, then you can prescribe chronic Xanax. Ativan is longer acting. I think we're always cautious because people do also seek that feeling of not anxiety with any of the benzodiazepams. Valium is a bit longer acting than Ativan, and Buspar is a bit longer acting than that. So anybody remember the 60? We'll look around and see if I think so. Maybe only a couple. Valley of the Dolls in the 60 about benzodiazepam abuse. Yeah. So there was a medication, and I'm having trouble remembering it now. I can remember one name of it. Even before Valium, which was the anti-anxiety medicine, that was Miltown. What was? Meprobamate. Exact. Miltown, meprobamate, and there was one other. Well, Librium. Librium was, and I think we still use Librium like we might use Vistarol in some withdrawal syndromes, but meprobamate was the one that was commonly used before Valium. And then Valium became the most prescribed drug in the world, and so we use it cautiously now. We still use it for sedation. We still can use Valium for sedation, but it is a long-acting anti-anxiety. Depression often comes with pain, acute and chronic pain, so antidepressants and mood stabilizers may be an adjunctive therapy to pain management. So pain management and the addiction problem. Pain management, I think, is important. Let me just say, sometimes Ann and I, Melissa Paulitz, Dr. Luck, Dr. Gunderson are called to do pain management. But in palliative medicine, we are symptom management experts. Pain is the number one symptom, so hopefully we're pretty good at it. But we take care of all symptoms, dry eyes, constipation, shortness of breath. We're symptom assessment and management experts. While pain management, that specialty is often attributed to anesthesiologists that do interventions, that do nerve blocks and epidurals and intrathecal. Interventional radiology also does some of that in pure pain management. So thank you for being. Any thoughts about the opioid crisis, both the crisis out there for addiction and our crisis for being now undersupplied? And it looks like from President Trump's address in New Hampshire yesterday that he's going to put pressure on the manufacturers to make even less, And, you know, in hospice, pain management is often the whole concept of caring for somebody, get them comfortable. And we try to get them comfortable within hours of arriving in hospice, and the families are often so relieved. You know, I haven't seen mom this comfortable in weeks, and they're often very gracious because we don't look at a milligram of morphine to control the pain. We'll use a bucket of morphine if that's what it takes. Now, that's not an official prescription, a bucket of morphine, but the point is that it's the pain that's the issue and not limiting the medication. We look for all sorts of non-medication interventions to bring comfort and relief from distressing syndromes. And I think we're going to have a real concern in the opioid crisis. We're going to have to learn how to use Demerol again. You all have never learned that the first time. Now will be the first time. But that's what's going to happen here at Boca Hospital is we're going to be using Demerol because we're running out of the other medicines, and that's our crisis. Yes? Thoughts? So when you say doctors need to check on, what are they checking on? Prescription refills by that patient? Okay. I know in some states the tracking is of the patient, and they have to show some identification, a driver's license to get a fill. In other states, they're tracking the physicians, how many narcotic prescriptions a doctor writes. I think tracking the patient, you make such a good point. Only 20% of the issue is related to pills and prescriptions. The other is street drugs. Very good. Other thoughts? Yes. Yep. So here's a question over here, and then I'll come back. Yes, sir. Oxygen. I mean, yeah. Well, Roxanol is morphine, but it's sublingual morphine, so we're sticking with morphine. One of the things that we've had to do in palliative and hospice medicine is find out, well, we don't have enough subcutaneous or IV morphine, but we have enough other forms of morphine, like oral or sublingual. So we're using the same medication, but by a different route. The problem is that here at Boca Hospital, we're even running out of other route morphines. And so we are going to be very limited. And what you're up against is what we're all up against. You know, one of the issues, let me confess, morphine is so commonly used that we look at the side effects, the three-day side effects of anxiety and maybe nausea. But we also look at the long-term side effects like constipation. It really doesn't go away. So remember, the rule is the hand that writes the opioid writes the bowel prep. So you probably hear that often. But we know a lot about morphine because we use it every day, six times a day. We use fentanyl, usually not even the Actique, very often because we have effective. So we're used to using the patches as one of the long-acting forms that you convert. So I'm not, on an everyday basis, familiar with the other potential benefits of reducing air hunger of fentanyl. We're used to using it as a long-acting analgesic. But I think we're all going to be head-shaking, going, what do we do now? You know, we've got Demerol, and it's a renal patient. So what do? Give them 2 milligrams instead of 25 and let it work for a week or until the next dialysis? You know, and that's the issue, the head-shaking issue. Great point. Yes, sir? Yeah, that's just last week, and that was in chronic pain. That's in over 6 month kind of pain. And actually, as it was reported, I had to go look it up because it was reported in the media. And the media story was that Advil is just as effective as morphine for pain. Well, that's not true. But in chronic pain, you know, chronic back pain, chronic lumbar compression pain, it's not surprising to us in palliative care that that is the case, that over-the-counter, non-steroidals, may be just as effective as those in chronic kinds of pain. But exactly. So my experience is sublingual is as fast as IV. And if you swallow it, it slows it down. So, you know, in our CMAX, IV is the fastest. You can give IV morphine. If somebody were dying right now in front of you with breathlessness and sarcoma pain, you could give morphine IV or sub-Q as often as every 10 to 15 minutes. You can give sublingual as often as every 15 to 30 minutes. And if it's going to be oral, you wouldn't even use oral if somebody was dying or having that kind of pain. It would probably take 30 to 45 minutes to be effective. So orals are probably the slowest. Ostomy, vaginal, rectal, or other very slow routes. But any GI absorption is going to be lower. I think look under the tongue, how vascular it is, and if you can keep a little liquid under the tongue, a moist tongue, not a dry mouth-breathing tongue, but a moist tongue, it's probably absorbed pretty quickly. So my first 10 years in hospice was in a home-based hospice, and we did not use any needles. And so sublingual morphine was the route of choice, and we could comfort anybody pretty quickly. Yeah, you had a thought. Yeah, so somebody comes to the emergency room. I was thinking about this the other day with flash pulmonary edema in the face of heart disease. So it was oxygen, morphine, Lasix. Oxygen, morphine, Lasix. And morphine's a vasodilator. If you didn't have oxygen or Lasix in flash pulmonary edema, you're still going to comfort the symptoms with only morphine, because besides having that euphoric effect that you don't look for in addiction, you do look for that effect in the emergency room or in combat. But so I think that's very interesting. Remember what the next step was after oxygen, Lasix, and morphine for flash pulmonary edema in the ER? Rotating tourniquets. Very good. Very good. Yes. So I probably didn't underscore that enough. Very good. When I said about acute pain management, I said give the dose and then you see the patient in an hour. I didn't say have somebody see the patient. Because you started it, you're assessing it, you're responsible for managing that pain. Thank you all so much. Appreciate your time. Thank you.